this cough this weekend. I think it's been hanging on for 2 months.
The House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development meeting for February 18th will come to order. I think representatives, we're going to approach this in kind of a backwards way this morning. And Representative Smith, can you hear us?
Yes, sir.
We have the work session items, which we'd like to do first because several of our members have other committee meetings. So we're going to go with HB 2137, and I open the work session on 2137. Zach, can you tell us what that is?
House Bill 2017 just makes technical changes to laws governing suspension and revocation of driving privileges.
And I think we have an amendment to it. Do all members have copies of the amendment to 2137?
I have them in a packet from Monday as well. Or from Monday.
Yeah, I did not have it, but this is it.
It's on the computer, I know that.
It's pretty short. Yeah. Do I hear a motion regarding the amendment?
Mr. Chair, I move that LC-1, dated 2/15, amendments dated on 2/15 to bill number 2137.
Is there further discussion? If not, the amendments are adopted. And now do I hear a motion for the HB 2137 adoption?
Mr. Chair,
I move 2137 be moved to the next step of the due pass recommendation.
Representative Smith moves HB 2137 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none, is there objection? Actually, I think I'll have the roll called on this. Could you call the roll, please?
Representative Lindsay?
Excused.
Representative Nathanson?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Weiner?
Aye.
Vice Chair Beyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan?
Aye.
Chair Vann?
Aye.
And Chair Reed?
Excused. If there's the motion passes. And I need a carrier. Any volunteers to carry? Seeing none, I'll carry. That puts the rest of you online for the next bill, which is much more difficult and challenging. So with that, I'm going to keep the work session open, but open a work session on HB 2138. I think we have an amendment to this one also.
Mr. Chair, I move the LC-2 amendments dated 2/11 to bill number 2138.
Representative Sheehan moves to adopt the LC-2 amendments dated 2/11/11. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Seeing none, the amendments are adopted. Do I have a motion on the bill?
Mr. Chair, I move that Bill 2138 be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Sheehan, as amended. Representative Sheehan moves House Bill 2138 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Lindsay.
Excused.
Representative Davidson.
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Weidner?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Beyer? Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan?
Aye.
Chair Vann?
Aye.
Chair Reed?
Excused. The motion passes. And we need a carrier. Representative Sheehan, thank you very much. Representative Sheehan carries. All right, with that, we are going to close the work session, and we're going to move to House Bill 2210, And I think we need Representative Huffman. I'm going to open a public hearing and possible work session on 2210.
Thank you, Chair Bentz and committee. John Huffman, State Rep for District 59, and lest you have forgotten, that's Wasco, Sherman, Gillum, Wheeler, Grant, Jefferson. I mean, the lion's share of Grant, anyway, and Jefferson County, a little bit of northern Deschutes, and tiny bits of Clackamas and Marion counties. We're here today with a simple driver's ed bill to give us a fix with ODOT funding. And I'm going to let Ron McDermott introduce himself in a second, and he and Troy Costales from Traffic Safety can explain it a little further as to why we need this fixed so that funding can flow through properly. But Sherman County schools, for reasons that Ron will explain, have not been able to provide driver's education. And I met with some of the sheriffs from my district just a couple of days ago and found out from Sheriff Gary Betancourt in Gillum County that this fix would actually work for the Gillum County schools also. So having said that, I'm going to sneak back next door to hear another bill that I'm working on, and I'm going to leave it to Ron and others to get into it and explain a little further what it is that we're trying to fix. I think you're going to find out it's pretty simple, pretty easy, no opponents, and it's all good. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. McDermott.
Yeah, my name is Ron McDermott. I'm the Sherman County Justice of the Peace. I spend most of my time adjudicating traffic in Sherman County, and in that through that perspective, I'm able to understand the importance of having drivers who are properly trained. I deal with a lot of the people that aren't properly trained. And about 5 years ago, a group that I chair, the Local Public Safety Coordinating Council for Sherman County, made it a priority to try to reestablish driver education in the Sherman County School District after a number of years of there not being a program. Our first step, of course, because schools traditionally handle driver ed, is we went to our school and asked them if we could help them get it started. And unfortunately, they told us they just didn't have the resources to start any kind of program, no matter how good it was. They said they'd give us a classroom if we could ever figure out a way to get a program. And that could have been the end of it. And what we did after that point is we briefly looked at Educational Service District or the possibility of a private driver school. We don't have anybody that can provide driver education in Sherman County because of our remoteness. So in talking to Troy Costales and the folks through the Traffic Safety Division, we came up with the concept of a county being a provider of driver education. And during the past 3 years, we have gone with, I guess, what you consider a trial. We've actually done this. It's been very successful. So the Sherman County Board of Commissioners felt so strongly about having driver education for our young people. They're providing it. We're ODOT certified. But there are clearly some areas in statute that should be cleaned up for this to be a long-term fix. That's what we're hoping to accomplish with House Bill 2210. And so we are proving that this is working. We don't want to take away the opportunity for someone else to provide driver's ed. But in Sherman County, it's just simply the last resort. And I do believe we could have probably several other counties in Eastern Oregon follow this model. So we're really we're pleased that this has been successful to date. I do strongly support the program. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Questions?
Yes.
Representative
Byer. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a may type of a situation, not a requirement, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
And is it possible, Mr. Chair, to have someone from the department come up and let us know how this fits in with their program?
I think it's an excellent idea. Do we have someone here from the department? Oh, yes, someone is waving at us from the back.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Troy Costales. I'm the administrator of the Transportation Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation, and be more than happy to answer questions that you have about how the counties fit into this particular process.
Perhaps you could just go ahead and tell us.
Yes, sir. Currently, under law, the providers for driver education in the state are public school districts, community colleges, educational school districts, and through Senate Bill 125 during the last session, opened it up for private companies to be a direct service deliverer of driver education. The curriculum, as in our rules, there's a set of minimum standards the curriculum must have in it, and the instructors that teach the program have a minimum level of education that they have. For the county governments currently to provide service, they essentially act as a subcontract to either an educational service district or to a public school district, which is the case that's presented to you today, is there's a connection between the school district and the county. What this bill would do is throw counties in there as a potential vendor. It is not a requirement that the counties offer this. And in certain cases around the state, the county would be the one basically giving the bricks and mortar location to a driver education program. And the whole program could be delivered through a private company or partially through a private company that probably wouldn't be in that area of the state to set up shop just simply because of the low numbers of kids that they would be able to reach. But they might be able to come out for the 2 or 3 weeks' time of a driver education program using the county facilities as the host for them to work under subcontract for the county. And it is a way and a method of reaching some of the more remote areas of the state where just simply the sheer volume of somebody setting up a shop there wouldn't provide the profit margin or the ability or number of clients for them to be in that location.
Questions? I have a couple.
Okay.
The first one is there some reason that we should be thinking about limiting this to rural counties?
Mr. Chair, I wouldn't think so at this point in time, given that the current system within Oregon is voluntary for driver education, and so there are places around the state currently that have providers in them that not 100% of the teens are taking driver education now. And so there may be some counties, if you will, in the I-5 corridor that might want to be in this, even though there are educational service districts or school districts that are offering it today. Not 100% of the students are being reached.
Thank you. You have a question?
Well, I do, unless you have others. Sorry. I just have one more question. When it comes to the funding source, do you see much of an impact on this fund if we expand it?
Mr. Chair and Representative Beyer, currently the account is set up to reimburse up to $210 per eligible student in order to lower the cost on the family and the teen for taking driver education. Our estimates based on the pilot program that's been running is that we would see probably no more than 100 students the first couple years that go through the county option of a program, so roughly $21,000 a year that would go out in student subsidy. We are currently processing around $1.8 million in student subsidy per year around the state to all the current approved providers. And so there is a little bit of a cost, but it is not one that bankrupts the fund that's there. The fund is solvent, has approximately $10 million in the current fund. And so having the added ability for expense-wise to reimburse the counties for these students is not a financial hardship for the fund as it sits today.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions? Thank you. Troy, you're not leaving. You're staying around in case we have a couple
more
folks signed up.
I'll be here for your whole hearing today.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we have two other witnesses, Mr. Hansen and Sandra Bishop. And by the way, Mr. McDermott, thank you very much for that long drive. It's a long ways to Sherman County.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rich Hansen. I am the president-elect for the Oregon Driver Traffic and Safety Education Association. And our board wishes to support this measure because of the following reasons. It provides an administrative body to oversee driver education in places where we normally don't have that. It provides an increase in access to driver education for kids who would normally not be served. And especially because it's not economically feasible, as Troy already mentioned, and it also removes the burden of some of the schools having to provide driver education in some of their limited budgets. We see this as a creative problem solving for times that need creative solutions, and so we recommend a do pass for this measure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Representative Bentz, members of the committee. My name is Sandra Bishop. I'm representing the Driving School Association of Oregon. We're the commercial driving schools, and we're here to support the bill 2210 for all of the stated reasons. But we are the private provider who will oftentimes be contracting with a public school, or in this case, we look forward to contracting with the counties to help to provide teen driver's ed throughout the state. Thank you.
Questions for the panel? I had just a couple, and I think you've appeared before our transportation committee before, and I think the question I had then was, what is the cost in total? The state reimburses the $210. What is normal for someone, if you do enter into a contract in Sherman County, to pay for the service?
Representative Bentz, I do not have an answer to that. It really varies depending on the expenses involved. There are other people testifying on Senate Bill 2140 who can probably give you a much better idea. I would only be guessing.
Well, since we have someone else testifying, we won't have to ask you to guess, so that's good.
And I can get back to you with a figure later.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we have no one else signed up on this bill. What's the pleasure of the committee? It seems to me this is a bill we could work, but we would have to go and retrieve one of our members.
Jefferson Smith of Canada's quorum.
Really? All right, well, then that's good. If there's no objection, we'll open a work session on this bill.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2140.
I'm closing the public hearing, opening the work session. Your motion.
It is 2140, right?
2110.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2110 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Did Nancy join us? Representative Nason join us in time to be part of this?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I'm just looking at 2140.
Representative Byer has moved House Bill 2110 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
2210. Mr. Chair, I amend my motion to House Bill 2210.
To the floor. Let's try that again. Representative Byer has moved House Bill 2210 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Lindsay. Representative Nathanson?
Aye.
Representative
Smith? Aye. Representative Weiner?
Aye.
Vice Chair Byer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan?
Aye.
Chair Benz?
Aye.
Chair Reed?
Excused. The motion passes. I think we need a carrier. Representative Byer. Representative Weiner?
You haven't had one yet.
I have. We both have. Is there anyone who hasn't had one?
I'll take it.
Okay. Representative Widener carries. Thank you.
Good bill should pass.
With that, let's reopen the public hearing and move to 2140. And Zach, would you tell us about 2140?
House Bill 2140 requires a person under 18 years of age who resides in Clackamas, Ultima, or Washington County to complete traffic safety education course prior to them being able to be issued a professional driver's license. Provisional driver's license.
Provisional. Okay, we have a number of people signed up. Let's start with Don Kreitz, Troy again, Constellis, and Kathy. Is it Hector?
Eater.
Who would like to go first?
I guess I'll go first, Mr. Chair. Troy Costales, Transportation Safety Division Administrator for the Oregon Department of Transportation. Thank you for scheduling House Bill 2140 this afternoon. Just a quick little bit of background. Conversation around teen driving started in this building, actually, in 1989. Because in 1988, 126 teens lost their lives in car crashes around the state. So the legislature, at that point in time, took the step forward and actually created, at that time, the provisional license, the very first set-aside for 17 and 18-year-olds to have a special license with some special restrictions. Then forward to 1999, and actually in this room, with Representative Montgomery chairing House Transportation Committee.
Mr. Chair, can we have the speaker speak into the microphone a little bit better? I was able to hear a little bit better earlier, but not right now.
Thank you, Representative Smith. We will so instruct the folks testifying.
Try and move it a little bit closer.
Please.
Thank you. So in 1999, Representative Montgomery, chair of House Transportation Committee, had saw a beginning of another uptick to teen driving-related fatalities and initiated House Bill 2440 in the 1999 session that added further restrictions to teen drivers, which had to deal with no driving at night, limiting their passengers, and requiring and making sure that they're wearing seatbelts actually any point in time that they're involved in riding the car. At the same time, in Senate Transportation Committee, there was a question around then the handling and management of the driver education program for the state of Oregon. So Senate Transportation amended that bill and moved the responsibility of driver education from Department of Education to ODOT Safety Division. And so since March of 2000, the driver education program has been in the Safety Division of ODOT. With that effort in 1999, there was a direct tie of driver education to the teen graduated driver license, put in an incentive to take driver education, but did not mandate it. Currently, a teen, while on their permit, must do 50 hours of driving time behind the wheel with a licensed adult. In addition to that, they have an option. They can take an ODOT-approved driver education course, or they do an additional 50 hours of driving time. Around the state, between 8,000 and 9,000 teens take the option of taking driver education currently in most counties all across the state, predominantly along the I-5 corridor, but there are teens that do take driver education in most counties. There are approximately 14,000 that are choosing to do the 100 hours. When we were given the responsibility in 1999, we were told, establish a curriculum standard for those things that are getting teens in trouble behind the wheel, what is causing crashes, and what are getting them citations. So the focus on the curriculum in three stages over the last 10 years was to get to a spot of having a curriculum that dealt with the high priority needs of teen driving. At the same time, there was no training for instructors to teach driver training. So we established, with the cooperation of Western Oregon University, the teacher training module. And for somebody to be a fully certified instructor for driver education, driver training, it's about 100 to 110 hours of training, much less than, for instance, the 1,500 hours that it takes for someone to be able to cut your hair for barbers and hairdressers. But it's very specific to the teen driving task and the driving module. And it has worked. Both the graduate driver license and driver education have worked. Attached to the testimony is a table showing what has happened with 16 and 17-year-olds behind the wheel when someone's been killed or injured. And the yellow chart on the top is dealing with just the 16-year-olds. The year prior to the provisional license going in and the incentive for driver education, almost 1,200 teens, 16-year-olds, were behind the wheel when someone was killed or injured, 100 times a month. A 16-year-old was in control of the vehicle, resulting in someone being killed or injured. And you can see over time, out to 2009, that number has dropped to 450. That's a 62% reduction in the number of 16-year-olds behind the wheel. And then you cast down and look at the chart below that for 17-year-olds, which, while not directly affected by driver education, your hope is that what you've taught them has carried forward to their driving as a 17-year-old, and from 1,500 down to 800, which is a 46% reduction. The national standard for implementing a graduated driver licensing program is 9 to 12% reduction. And for our 16-year-olds, it was 62%. For our 17-year-olds, it was 46%. Way outpacing what would have been expected if we had adopted the national model and done versus doing it the Oregon way and putting in the priorities that the legislative body set in motion. Then you see those gray pullouts on the last 3 years. And the reason for that was that in 2005-2006, the U.S. Department of Transportation came to Oregon to evaluate our graduated driver licensing program, and specifically calling out what has happened with those kids that are voluntarily taking driver ed. While everybody as a teenager, the crash numbers were going down, Those that take driver ed were even outperforming better than those around them. And in the crash area, 11 to 20% fewer crashes for those taking driver ed than those that were all completely 100 hours of parent or other licensed driver taught. Between 20 and 25% fewer citations, and between 50 and 60% fewer suspensions by those that are taking driver education compared to those that are not. And from the very beginning of the voluntary system, we have had public and private partnerships, and you heard a little bit of discussion about that during the last bill, where there are private companies that are part of the public sector offering the program, and as of last session, Senate Bill 125 allowed private contractors to deliver the program in whole, all on their own, without being underneath a subcontract. Our issue in Oregon is the infrastructure. When we look at the fact that there are roughly 23 to 24,000 16-year-olds that would go forward for their license, we do not have schools, public and or private, out there to be able to turn the light switch and say, this is a good thing and we're going to require it for everybody. We do not simply have enough schools and instructors and vehicles around the state in order to provide that service. But the fact that we have such a good story to tell, coming forward to you with this bill, is starting about with a pilot project of looking at the Tri-County. You may ask the question, why the Tri-County? Simply because that is where there is infrastructure, where there are schools and locations and sites. And in the very last page of the testimony, there is a Tri-County map, just giving you an indication of within those three counties that there are 25 approved providers, as well as then there are 43 individual site locations within the Tri-County area where driver education is currently taught. So looking at it from saying we're going to flip the switch and go from a voluntary to mandatory, what we're providing to you is the recommendation of looking at the Tri-County area, because that is where the infrastructure was most likely to be able to handle the uptick in the number of students that would be involved. We've held two open house, one face-to-face and one webinar with driver education providers, public and private, and have asked them specifically, can you double the amount of kids that you're handling today to be able to meet the demand if this bill was to pass and become law? And everybody who was in that room that day said that they could. There are some, in fact, that indicated that they would look to hire additional people or some part-time people that would go full-time in order to handle that increased need. So the in 1999, sat in this room and the Senate side as well, and was asked to take on a program and fix it. And it's actually a quite astonishing thing to be sitting here today in front of you 10 years later, roughly, showing you a successful program that has made a difference, that has saved lives, have made kids better drivers, and them being adult drivers today for those that were in the first wave. And to ask you to take on the policy conversation of, do we start now to look at moving from a voluntary to mandatory program, where we know this is a program that saves lives and makes kids a much better driver and, in turn, much better citizens within the state of Oregon. And with Mr. Chair, I would be more than happy to answer questions or wait till other testimony is over and wrap up for you.
Thank you, Troy. We will wait. Which of our other two folks would like to go next?
I will.
Hi, my name is Kathy Heaton, and I work for America's Driving School. I'm a commercial school. I've been teaching for 30 years. I am definitely for mandatory driver's ed. I always have been. I think it is a good thing. But there's some things in the rules that I want you to look at so that you can make a decision on all students, not just some. Some of the issues that I have is, if a student fails, there needs to be more in writing what we should do about that failed student. Right now, they would be kicked out. I currently am not part of the ODOTA program, and I choose to not at this time for the fact that I do all private drives. I do one-on-one private drives, not two students in the car. I get foreigners that request it. I get handicapped students. Many DVR clients are calling me, asking me to work with their students. Many public school systems have contacted me and asked me to work with the students that have either failed in the public school or other programs. And I have a real heart for the handicapped. I have cars that have dual controls. I have leg extenders. And I will work, and a lot of my concerns on my issues are time frame. I'm a little concerned on there's a certain time frame we have to meet to get the funding. I would not be able to extend that without prior approval. And I feel that I'm the best decision maker on that prior approval of extending time if they need it or to work one-on-one. I have to get that approved. There has to be more than one in the car. They have to observe. And they have to have observation time. And there are foreigners that come to us. They're also on the drive route that I have concerns on is we do have to submit to qualify for these rules, our drive routes. There will be times I will stay in a parking lot the whole lesson because of the skill of the student I have. And I would not be able to qualify them in the 6 hours. And I would want to continue working with them, which I currently do, but I wouldn't want a time frame. I might tell a parent, let's wait 6 months, let's wait 3 months, and let's see if they develop. And maybe you can work with them, and I'll work with the parent and tell them what they need to do. So I want some things addressed for if they fail. I get a lot of failed students. I do have a classroom, 30 hours, and I do have behind the wheel. And my hours start at 6, but they go up from there because I have more programs. And I don't want such, I feel that I wouldn't qualify for anybody under 18. With the way my program is set up, that I'm currently working, I would not be able to teach any student under 18. I would have to tell them all, you have to wait till you're 18. As it stands now, I'm able to teach them. I'm able, the 100 hours, we just tell the student, you have to have the 100 hours. And then I can teach you. And I teach a classroom and behind the wheel. And I gave Troy several years ago several of my students the permit numbers and names of students to run checks on them to see how good of a driver my students are. And he said I fell up in the category where the rest of them are on doing well for driver's ed. And I need to have you look at time frame, private drives. I work a lot with handicap that need differences. And I find one-on-one training, I get more response from the child. They will tell me what's wrong. They will tell me what their concerns are. They will tell me what they don't understand when their friend is not in the back seat. And they have been an observer for 16 years in the back seat with the parent. And I want to be able to work with them unlimited. I don't want time frames. I want you to look at, and I don't want to have to send in a letter to ask permission for that. I think I am a good enough decision maker up to this many years. I work with the elderly. I work with the young. I work with every different type of student. So I think that the OAR needs to have some exemptions to this. Do you have any questions from me on?
We may. And you've raised a lot of very good points, but we'll go to our third panel member first.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Don Kreitz. I'm the president of Oregon Driver Education Center, a private driving school, which also runs an ODOT-approved program in the Tri-County area under consideration. Thank you for the time to consider the changes in the existing teen driver licensing laws recommended by ODOT-TSD and Governor Kitzhaber. Here to urge your support for a minor change in the law which could have a major impact on the lives over the next few years. Of the 69 Oregon Traffic Safety Committee action plan items, the expansion of driver education was among the 9 key action items. The legislation to make driver education mandatory for new drivers under the age of 18 is at the top of the list for designing a model program. According to the report, quote, this will reduce the overrepresentation of 16 and 17-year-old drivers in fatal and injury crashes. 16 and 17-year-olds account for 6% of the fatal and injury crashes in the state. In 2000, there were 2,099 fatal and injury collisions among 16 and 17-year-olds with an economic cost of $117 million per year, unquote. Under current Oregon law, 16 and 17-year-olds may opt for additional practice time in lieu of completing an approved traffic safety education course. According to ODOT-TSD records, 8,654 students completed a driver education course in 2008, while 18,511 did not. By removing the practice option, the number of fatal and injury crashes involving 16 and 17-year-olds would drop roughly 244 per year. That's on a statewide basis. 37 states already require driver education prior to licensure. Although 92% of Oregonians support mandatory driver education, the funding question is often raised. Only 13 of those states which require driver education provide any tuition assistance, usually in the form of school district funding. Oregon is only one of four states which subsidizes driver education through licensing fees. The present $210 ODOT assistance for driver education is very generous when compared to other states that do not require courses to be offered by school districts. With the passage of Senate Bill 125 this last session, the ability to expand to meet the demand is achievable without taxing public schools. Currently, all approved programs must offer assistance to low-income families. Oregon, under the leadership of Troy Kostalis, late John Harvey, and now Bill Warner, developed the most highly recommended driver education curriculum in the country. The number of 16 and 17-year-olds who have been involved in injury and fatal collisions within the past 10 years has dropped over 50%, from 2,655 in 1998 to 1,323 in 2008. With a standardized curriculum, high instructor training standards, tight regulation, and proven results, Oregon is ready to save more lives. Do you have any questions?
Questions? Do we have any questions for the panel? I'll have a couple. Troy, can you address some of the issues, the issue in particular that Ms. Heaton raised regarding the, I think most of those remarks focus on the administrative rule, but is there something in what she said that triggers in your mind something we ought to be doing to change that rule?
Well, Mr. Chair, bring this forward so Representative can hear on the phone. A couple items that were brought up in relationship to the one-to-one driving. The rules say that there will be time spent as a student in the seat as a witness, as a passenger, because part of the lesson plan in relationship to the drive route is in order to explain to everybody in the car what's coming up or what's happened or what lesson has been learned. And so the instructor is engaging all of those, as well as from a state agency public safety measure. You have young students in the car with an adult, and having more people around, as I do not want to get into a situation where there are claims against that particular teacher or that the instructor by one other individual and there's nobody else there. And so one of the behind-the-scenes things is for me, you know, to look at what the rules are. I don't ever want to put somebody in a situation where they're at risk simply because they're doing their job because of a claim, you know, whether it's true or false. But other people in the car is one of the things that I've worried about all along for the last 10 years about this program and about the driving part, because the classroom, there are more people that are around. In the essence of the failures, one of the pieces to that is that there are students that then do retake and retake either part or all of the course that is up to the individual school under the approved program when they're looking at that. Part of what we do is limit the reimbursement, though, to the time that they've taken the course the first time. The subsidy goes to that first class. The issue of handicap as well as foreign students, there are providers under the ODOT program that do both as well. And applaud Ms. Heaton because she's been one of the forefront individuals out there taking this on herself personally to make sure she learns about the needs of those individuals and making sure that they're taken care of within her program. Just wish you could coerce her to be part of the letter-approved program so her kids have that certificate to take to DMV. Mr. Chair, was raised about the private companies offering lots of different courses. This does not change that. Private companies can offer all kinds of things, hour-by-hour service. It just would not be part of that program that is the certificate because all of these teens still have to do 50 hours of drive time under the base permit time anyway. And programs that public and private companies can offer can be part of that base 50.
So the fact that we are forcing folks to complete, quote, a traffic safety education course that meets standards developed by the department isn't limiting, in your opinion. It wouldn't leave Ms. Eaton out. Is that what I'm hearing?
Ms. Chair, there are still the 50 base hours that the student has to achieve underneath that particular, under the base law of while under the permit. Would there be the program that Ms. Eaton offers, since it's not part of the ODOT program, would count towards that base 50. It would not be the class that is the certificate portion, the second half of the permit time.
I'm not sure that answered. I guess my question again is she going to be in any way affected, or her program, by this if this passes?
In the Portland County area, Mr. Chair, that there will be programs that are currently not part of ODOT that would stay not part of ODOT, and that the potential of losing clientele is a possibility if the parent chooses to not use the school as part of their base 50 hours like they're doing today.
Okay, well, did you have any other comments on what you heard her say that you would recommend that we do, or is the program as we see it being expanded here adequate?
Mr. Chair, most of what I think Ms. Heaton was talking about is in the administrative rule portion, right. And part of that would be as if the committee or legislature as a whole had some specific directions to the agency to look at changing rule versus putting it in statute. That's what started in 1999, is we were given specific charges of what to do that were not in statute. We were told to make sure we put this in rule. So we would take direction from the legislature if there were things in there that you were concerned about in the rule side versus getting into the specifics in statute, because the rules are lengthy, and I'd hate to all of a sudden have those adopted into statute.
Okay, well, I kind of need to know, I'm sure we all would like to know, the number of children that are going to be impacted by this in these three counties and what the cost is going to be for each of those families. Are they going to receive the subsidization regardless of economic circumstance? And there was a number of questions in this, but maybe you can just shotgun the response also.
Sure. Mr. Chair, respond to a couple of things. The expected count of students that we would see in the first year, we're expecting about 4,500 additional students to go through the driver education driver training, and all of those students would then in turn be eligible for up to $210 subsidy. In the earlier bill, you had asked a question about cost. For the providers under our program, we have seen costs anywhere from zero, because the local school district has chosen to pay for it themselves and just take the subsidy, up to $245 or $250 for the parent fee, with a subsidy being behind the scenes that the parent doesn't see.
So that's in addition to, so the total amount of the cost of the program per student is approximately, in those circumstances, how much?
$450 to $460, Mr. Chair. And there is currently in statute, as the Chair mentioned, a law that requires any and all providers have a program for low or no income students. And the two ways most programs are delivering that is, one, they have a sliding fee scale, and they establish where somebody is, and they have to prove to the individual provider where they fit, and then they have a sliding adjusted fee. The other is there are some providers that have received grants, and unfortunately within this area of the state, there was actually a life insurance policy for a teen that the family put towards the driver education program that is there in order to help other teens get driver education. The parents made that offer to a local provider. So it's there for low or no income students through the provider to be able to access. So a couple different ways that local providers are achieving the law requirement of having a low or no income process established for fees.
The question, I suppose, and you kind of addressed it, is that when the folks, if this passes, and all of a sudden those who are offering the classes are faced with a doubling in caseload, won't these fees go up? Wouldn't there be an automatic prompt to raise the price now that everybody has to do this?
Mr. Chair, the largest cost in relationship to the driver education program, in part, is the vehicle, because you're purchasing a vehicle and you actually have a classroom size of either 2 or 3 versus the classroom where you can have, you know, 15 or 20. In talking with the providers entering the open house, some providers indicated that they may need to pick up and purchase another car. They are able to then make that cost be part of the when they roll up their amount for the subsidy. So they can spread the cost out over a couple years based on the parent fee or based on the subsidies that the state gives them. There's already a wide variance of costs in the Portland area, again, from that 0 to 250, 260 per student. I would be hard-pressed to predict for you what would the cost change to. For those providers that already have the infrastructure and are not starting up, you would assume that they probably have a lower cost compared to someone that might be wanting to start a new business or a new venture and what cost they may be taking on at the onset.
Further questions for this panel? I think, Ms. Eaton, you might have had something to add.
Yeah, I do feel I would lose that business 100% from 17 and 16-year-olds that and 15 that I currently have, because I would, if I did not go with the if I stayed with the private driving, that would make it so I could not qualify for this program. So I would, and I'm the only school left that I know of that has stayed with traffic safety classroom and behind the wheel without being ODOT approved. And I feel that the private schools have been affected by this. And my business has drastically dropped. I used to have 5 cars. I'm now down to 2. And I used to have close to almost 15 instructors at one point. And now I'm down to 4. So my business, when it changed to you can get 100 hours, I still had business. This will make it, I'll have none. I want to meet them at home. I want to meet them at school. You know what I do on the lessons? I take them to all the areas they're going to drive when they first start. The first year is where they get into the trouble. And I take them to these areas. And if I find problems, I work with these problems. I work on a one-on-one individual with every student. I don't have a set route, but I have set agendas. And I know exactly what I need to cover. And I keep working with the student. They might stay on lesson one for 3 lessons. I don't move them on until they can move on. And I want one-on-one, and I want to meet them at home. And this will take this away. I had the option or up to now.
Question.
Thank you, Chair. Real quick, Troy, I commend you for the program that you run. I think you do an outstanding job. And I feel for you and what you're going through, because I understand the private public very well. My question is for you, Troy. Because I understand the situation, I would hate to see us stray from having multiple people in the car, just because of liability reasons and stuff. But how hard is it to become a certified driver education teacher through your program? What steps would I have to take if I wanted to go out and get a car and start teaching driver's ed classes for you today?
Mr. Chair and Representative Widener, 2 parts to starting up a business in the driver education program. One is on the curriculum side, having a curricula that meets or exceeds the items that we've listed as high priority. We do, as Mr. Kreitz mentioned, we have a state curriculum that's out there if people choose to use it, and a handful of other states have actually adopted Oregon's. So you could adopt that, and the curriculum is already done. The work you would have to do is your individual drive route based on where you are located in the state. The second is, which is the time piece, and that's for you to be trained. There are 3 classes that an instructor goes through. One called Foundations, which is the basic pieces of instructing, both and giving you the how to link things together in the teen learners of today. The second is specific to behind-the-wheel training. If that's what you're choosing to do, is as you're part of it, you learn the physics of behind-the-wheel and the elements of teaching driving behind-the-wheel. The third is the classroom side of it. What you're trying to deliver in the class, different options you can deliver in the class, and how classroom and the driving go together. So you have the theory and then the practice of teaching driving. All told, those three classes, if you were to do all three, is 110 to 120 hours. And the state subsidizes the cost behind that other than the books that you use that you then in turn have as your own property. And it is contracted through Western Oregon University in Monmouth. And they have lead instructors that go all over the state and will actually come into a location of only one or two people if that's what's needed for people to be trained. They'll send a master trainer out in order to help those two adults become driver ed instructors and be certified.
Thank you.
Further questions? Yes, Representative Sheehan.
Mr. Chair, would this program cause insurance companies that are currently incentivizing driver's ed, voluntary driver's ed compliance, will that cause them to lower their discounts or eliminate it?
Mr. Chair and Representative Sheehan, when we've talked for many years in the highway safety business with insurance, it's all based on the underwriting and what they see actually happen in the crash and injury and claim statistics. I can tell you a personal story. My son is 20. 5 years ago, he went through the driver education program. He also did more than 100 hours, and he also did our insurance company's booklet. You know, driver training was his world for a little bit during his permit. His first 6 months, or our first 6 months of bill is him as a 16-year-old driver. It cost us $245 for the course, to take the course. The first 6 months, he had approximately $175 deduction on his insurance policy because he took driver ed. He had a 30-some-odd dollar reduction because he was a good driver, didn't have any citations or crashes, and he was a good student, so he had additional on top of that. The first 6 months alone almost paid back to his parents the fee that it took for him to take driver ed. But that reduction is solely up to the insurance companies of what they're going to offer or not. In statute currently, there is a requirement for someone that takes the driver training classroom for an older driver. If they were to go through, for instance, AARP's 55 Alive program, there's a mandatory discount statute says the insurance companies must give them. And now, as of last session, Senate Bill 546, I believe, had a requirement in there that if an individual takes the motorcycle training course within 3 years, that they will get a discount from their insurance carrier. In the world of teen driving, it is solely up to the individual companies as to whether they give a discount or not under current law today.
Mr. Chair, follow up?
Please.
Do you know of any other states where it's mandated and insurance companies do not offer the same sort of discount? I'm just worried about if we're mandating it, there's not much incentive for insurance companies to make it cheaper for people.
Mr. Chair and Representative Sheehan, I do not know the answer to the question. I would have to query some of the other 30-plus states that have mandatory driver ed to ask the additional question of insurance. We queried them as far as how it tied to the licensing and whether they did subsidy. We did not ask them a question about insurance.
I'd love to know the answer to that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions? So, you know, we have two more people to speak, but Troy, one of the things that I would like is a very brief summary, if you could, of Ms. Heaton's concerns, so that we could see just exactly why it is that we're not able to fit what she has going. And I think I understand it, but I want to see it in writing, and I'd sure like to share it with my co-chair before we move the bill, if we move the bill. So, with that. Is that going to be difficult for you to provide for us?
Mr. Chair, if I can get a copy of Ms. Heaton's written notes, we will show you point by point and walk through them for you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, we also have Rich Hansen and Sandra Bishop signed in. They could come up.
Go ahead. Well, first of all, let me get you some testimony here. If you would like.
I said, Rick, it's actually Rich, isn't it?
It's Rich, yes.
Sorry about that.
No worries. I used to say you can call me anything, just don't call me late for dinner. Sorry. On a more serious note, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Richard Hansen, and I am the president-elect for Oregon Driver and Traffic Safety Education Association. I'm also a driver ed teacher at the Tiger Tualatin School District. I'm an adjunct instructor for Western Oregon University and for Castleton College in Vermont. I'm the 2005 Oregon Driver Education Teacher of the Year and the 2006 National Driver Education Teacher. And I'm also a national consultant to 5 states on their curriculum development and to 9 states on their teacher preparation. I'm a busy fellow, but I love it. And I truly, truly believe in driver education. I'm here representing OTSEA, which is the Oregon Driver and Traffic Safety Education Association, and I'm testifying in support of House Bill 2140. OTSEA is the largest driver education association in the state of Oregon, supporting teachers, administrators, and students, and its mission is to continually improve driver education in Oregon.
Mr. Hansen, since you've given us the written testimony, you don't have to read it to us.
Perfect.
What you can do is summarize it for us, and we would all appreciate that very
much.
Okay.
Very much. Thank you. Anyway, we are here to support it because we believe in driver education. We believe that mandating driver education will help reduce teen crashes and reduce teen fatalities. We also believe that we don't want to see the last 10 years go away in the progress and gains we've made in reducing teen crashes. We think driver education can do that, and we think that it can do it effectively if it's held to a high standard and it meets a certain degree of qualifications. We've done a lot of work in trying to help providers get to a level of performance by enacting certain standards that are held in Oregon administrative rules. We've also worked in developing curriculum. We've helped develop teacher preparation and teacher mentoring, and we're excited about seeing the possibility of implementing this new law. In 2003, Oregon educators worked together to develop the nationally recognized curriculum that's available to every driver education provider here in the state of Oregon for free. It's loaded with a whole bunch of different administrative guidelines. It has a bunch of it has classroom materials, behind-the-wheel materials. It has documents that can be used in solid and CD form. They can pull it off and use everything they need to do, and it doesn't require a lot of extra work on the part of the instructors. We also worked on developing teacher standards, teacher preparation standards. Troy already mentioned the teacher preparation standards, and that we have 3 classes that are provided by a cadre of instructors that go all over the state of Oregon to deliver driver education. And I'm currently one of those trainers, and I've been to Ontario, Brookings Harbor, to Bend. I've been to Fossil. I've been all over the place to help support driver education here in the state of Oregon, along with another group of about 15 other people. Some things that I've included in your packet for you are things like in-car lesson plans. Some of those will help kind of address some of the things that Heaton was talking about. And they include just kind of a representation from my own program that shows the lesson plans that's in the next packet that you have. Also, I have route plans that are in there that describe point by point where certain teaching is going to occur. So I make sure that those objectives are covered within those lesson plans. It's part of the Oregon administrative rules that are there to exist to help make sure that we transfer the knowledge we want the kids to have in the behind-the-wheel lesson. I also included a copy of a parent communication piece, and in that parent communication piece, it shows what the kid has been working on, what kinds of skills they've developed, where they need to practice more frequently, and then it gives the parent the opportunity to do so, and it helps establish the partnership and tie all the pieces together between the classroom and also between the in-car experience for the kids. And then finally, I just want to say that these pieces are in place, and the pieces are in place to enact this law. This is a really good law. And the teachers are trained, the curriculum is developed, the program standards are in place, and the auditing process, which will evaluate and make sure that all the programs maintain the highest standards of delivery, are there. There's no question that the passage of this bill is going to benefit our members. But that's not the purpose I'm here for today. I'm here because of the kids. It's all about the kids. And if we can reduce crashes, and I don't have to go to another stand-up faculty meeting that tells us that we lost another kid in our high school because he was driving poorly,
That's a great victory. It's something that's worth investing in. And I want to say thank you for my opportunity to testify.
Thank you. And thank you for summarizing your testimony.
No problem.
We appreciate it.
Thank you. Sandra Bishop again, representing the Driving School Association of Oregon. I'm also going to present some testimony from George Doddington, who's president of the association. He is at home with someone from ODOT TSD department as they look over his program, so he's unable to be here today. The Driving School Association of Oregon, DSAO, supports House Bill 2140. Approximately 20 to 25 commercial driving schools operate in Oregon under DMV certification. Approximately 30% of the teen drivers who take driver education in Oregon take courses offered by 3 to 5 of the large commercial schools. The economic impact of this legislation on the public will be offset by a couple of different factors. Most insurance companies, as Troy demonstrated with actual figures, most insurance companies offer a discount for teen drivers who've completed a certified driver's ed program. So any tuition costs will be made up by the reduced rate reduced amount in the insurance premiums in a relatively short time usually. Currently, ORS requires providers of certified driver education programs to have a scholarship or a reduced tuition program of some sort to help the lower-income families. The requirement also, it's important to remember, the requirement will only cover drivers under the age of 18 and who have been statistically proven to be at the greatest risk for crashes, greater than any other age group. And we believe that any program that encourages and increases driver's ed for 16, 17-year-old drivers is very good to support. And also, one of the things that may happen with this mandatory program is that some young drivers will choose to wait until they're 18 or over to get those licenses. We believe that that's not a bad outcome of this program either. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for the panel? What's your failure rate?
Our failure rate's pretty low. We really invest quite a bit in our kids. And if I could follow up and address a couple of comments from Heaton, we have built into our policy manual that if a kid, at Tiger Tualatin anyway, if a kid fails a program, that they can take the program again for free without cost, because we believe that they're going to get a better opportunity to drive more safely. We also, the one-on-one thing, just to address a couple of things there, we have a policy that no student can be in a car singly with an instructor for several reasons. One, it's for their personal safety. Two, it's for their professional safety. And we want to make sure that the opportunity exists for that student to practice partnership as a passenger in a car, because those kids are going to haul passengers around, and if they can learn how to work with another teen in a car and learn how they can effectively support one another in the driving process, we believe that's accomplishing a huge goal. Our cost, to address a couple of things there, we have built in our policy that if a sliding scale for those students who are on free and reduced lunch, if a student is on a reduced lunch, they only have to pay $100 tuition. And if a student is on free lunch, they only have to pay $50. We believe that it's important that they invest so that they continue to practice and also continue to participate in a class, not just simply take it for granted. So we think that helps address the issue of those students who are low income.
Thank you very much. Yes, Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about... I was concentrating a little bit more on listening than reading at the same time and looking for information here, but there's something in the testimony about route plans. It says route plans are the roadmap to success. Trying to understand a little bit more specifically what that means, does that mean the same route is used throughout the student's tenure with this course, and the same route is used literally for every student, or might an instructor have two or three different routes that are planned out? You know, we're going to drive in this kind of a neighborhood for these lessons and this kind of an area somewhere else. So what can you tell me just a bit more about what it means to have set route plans?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nathanson, thanks for the question. That's an excellent question. We have 9 different drives for our program. And there are a lot of other programs that have 6 different drives. And what I did is I put together a packet for Drive 3 that has the route plan that all students that are doing Drive 3 will go through in order to practice those very specific skills. And if you'll notice in the center column, there is a list of objectives that are listed out that each student is going to have to accomplish at those specific and discrete locations. And then at the next column, the third column, is the behaviors that the instructor is going to evaluate specifically at those locations so that there's a consistency of delivery and a consistency of evaluation for every single student. So that's for Drive 3. Now, we do have more than one drive route for Drive 3, and so they can choose to do a different one. So we don't have, for instance, in the summer at Tualatin High School, we have 5 driver ed cars. And you can imagine 5 driver ed cars all leaving Tualatin High School at one time driving through the neighborhood, and you kind of have this parade of driver ed cars. And so we do provide some opportunities for them to go to different locations, but having the same objectives, having the same behaviors that are evaluated, and having the same outcomes looked for.
Further questions? So one final question. So over the years, you must have ridden with any number of student drivers, and you don't seem to have a nervous twitch, or you have most of your hair.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the comment. One of my students asked me, Mr. Hansen, do you ever get nervous? And I said, I do, but you'll never know. I actually have the strongest legs, I think, of anybody ever in finished, because that's where all my tension seems to go. I'm not exactly sure why, but otherwise it's kind of like the duck paddling, you know, it looks really calm on the surface, but paddling like crazy underneath.
I thought he was going to say it was to apply the brake.
No.
Oh, we appreciate both your testimony very much. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We have no one else signed up on this bill, and with the committee's acquiescence, I would like to not have a work session today and wait to hear back from the department. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on 2140. I'm going to reopen the work session on HB 2210 for the purpose of restating our motion.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move to suspend the rules to reconsider House Bill 2210.
It's been a motion to suspend the rules to reconsider House Bill 2210. Is there objection? Seeing none, I don't think I'll call the roll. So rule suspended to reopen the work session on HB 2210.
Mr. Chair, I guess this bill needs to go to Ways and Means. So I would like to move that House Bill 2210 be approved and sent to the floor with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
I think is it to the floor with a
due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay, Representative Byers moved the House Bill 2210 to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Is there further discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Lindsay?
Excuse me. Representative Nathanson?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative
Weiner?
Aye.
Vice Chair Byers?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Sheehan?
Aye.
Chair Bant?
Aye.
And Chair Reed?
Excused. The motion passes. With that, we'll close the work session on 2210 and open a public hearing on 2192. And do we have some folks signed up? I'm sorry, Zach, please state the nature of the bill.
House Bill 2192 just clarifies that the Universal Service Fund is able to expend monies to survey and map for broadband where broadband services are available in the state.
Thank you. We have a number of people signed up. Let's go with the first three, Brant Wolf, Barb Young, Ryan Conway. And since we just have 4, if Renee Willer wants to come up at the same time, that's fine. Grant, do you want to go first?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brant Wolf. I represent the Oregon Telecommunications Association. The OTA represents landline telecommunications carriers that operate throughout the state. The bill before you today basically is kind of a cleanup from a bill from the 2009 session. The testimony lays it all out for you, but to summarize, the federal government made some monies available to the states to map the availability of broadband in their state. In order to access that fund or those monies, the state had to come up with a 20% match. In 2009, the Public Utility Commission came to the landline carriers to determine if we would object to some of those funds from the Universal Service Fund being used for this purpose. The reason they came to the landline carriers is because our customers, along with the wireless customers, pay in. Nope, I take that back. Our customers, not the wireless customers, pay into the state Universal Service Fund. After talking it over and considering it, we decided we would not object to this purpose. The language that was agreed to among all the parties basically said the state can use. Well, you can read it. It's in the bill. It's in my testimony that the state could use that strictly for the mapping project. The language that was actually adopted is far broader than that, and in fact says the Public Utility Commission can use these funds to facilitate the availability of broadband, which is way beyond what we all agreed to. During the interim, we got together, and we being the landline carriers and the Public Utility Commission, and we agreed to go back to what we originally all had agreed to, and that's what this bill does. It's a very easy, non-controversial bill. If there is opposition to this, I am not aware of it at all. I Representative Nathanson, I know we had some problems connecting over the last couple of days, and you had a couple of questions, so I'll try and address them. Each state had this money available to them, and I believe that each state has done this or is doing it now, as Oregon is doing it, this broadband mapping project. I believe, at least as far in the state of Oregon, they haven't had to access this matching money yet out of the Universal Service Fund. They've been able to accomplish it with the federal grant and also some in-kind contributions, things of that nature. So I think it's been relatively cost-effective. I think that summarizes my testimony. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to address them. I know this is the first time you've heard this, but if the committee is willing, we would ask you to pass this out today with a do-pass recommendation to the floor. That's my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Wolf. I think we're going to have a hard time doing that today because we don't have a
fiscal statement.
Fiscal, so.
Oh, I didn't know one was needed. I apologize.
I just have a fiscal statement committee. So.
I'm sorry?
Every bill has to have a fiscal statement issued. Just the fiscal is running a little behind.
I see.
Okay, Barb. Barb Young.
Chairman, committee members, my name is Barb Young. I am the State Government Affairs Director for CenturyLink. CenturyLink, as of right now, is a small independent carrier in Oregon serving parts of the Columbia River Gorge, the coast, and southern Oregon. My testimony is very short. We support this bill and agree with Mr. Wolf's description that the original intent of the bill in 2009 was to be a very targeted distribution of funds from the Universal Service Fund to support the broadband mapping effort. The way the language is drafted, the way the language ended up in statute is very much broader than we anticipated it to be, thus the change in this bill in 2192. So appreciate your support and be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you. Mr. Conway.
All right. Good afternoon, Chairman Bentz.
If you could pull that microphone a little closer, Representative Smith is trying to listen on the phone.
Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Brian Conway. I'm the administrator of the Telecommunications Division for the Oregon Public Utility Commission. My comments are quite brief. The commission has not officially taken a position on this bill at this time. However, this language that Brandt is referring to was supported by the commission in the last session, and there have been no objections raised at the commission for this bill at this time.
Thank you. And that leaves Renee.
Thanks.
Good afternoon, Chair Benz, members of the committee. My name is Renee Willer, and I represent Frontier Communications. I'm the Government Affairs Manager. Just briefly, we support House Bill 2192 and the testimony of Mr. Wolf and Ms. Young. This bill simply modifies the language to what was agreed upon initially. It's non-controversial, and I urge you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Seems non-controversial, like just a ho-hum, but what this is using money that has been used for one thing and saying, let's use it for something different. Let's use it for a state match to bring in federal money to do a project. And the project, at first glance to me, looked like a good idea. Let's map broadband availability. But since I've been involved in telecommunications issues in the past, since the 90s, I started thinking, but we know a lot about broadband, and there have been other efforts to figure out, you know, where do we have access, where do we not have access, and I wish, frankly, we had a little bit more information about what really is the need for this, what's the purpose of the project, and what is the money being used for currently? Because although usually I'm very, very pleased to see industry and organizations saying that, you know, on behalf of their members, they're totally fine with this and they're happy to support it, I keep thinking, but what was the purpose of the universal service fee? What is it that money is supposed to be used for? It's to support Oregonians' access to broadband. What has the PUC or whatever other projects been spending the money on? And is this particular project more important than what we already spend the money on? Because I keep thinking back to the original purpose of that fee, and why are we going to start using it for something else? I just need to hear a little bit more about that.
Yes, Mr. Wolf.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nathanson, that's a great point. I appreciate it. And the association ordinarily takes a very, very dim view on taking funds and using them for something that they were not initially to be used for. I could not agree with you more. When we were approached for this, to back up, the fund is, if you don't know, the fund is to use to be, to support rural, or to make sure that telecommunication services are available throughout the state at reasonable and affordable rates, things of that nature. As we move into the future, we're moving away from dial tone telecommunication services and towards a broadband future. The reason I believe, and I don't want to testify for anybody else, but certainly for the association, the reason we thought that it would be okay for this one-time, limited, targeted use is to see where broadband was available and what was not available, and hopefully be able to kind of move in that direction. That's the only reason we went along with it. And I think I heard this. If I didn't, I apologize. But if this bill doesn't pass, that won't change. The money can, the bill, the language in the law already says you can use it for that right now. And this bill, the reason it's not controversial is because it kind of tightens it up. It makes sure that it doesn't go beyond that, in fact. And I think that's the non-controversial part of it, at least in my opinion. So, and I'd be happy to follow up with you as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a few brief comments then. And it will be nice to hear anything else you have to add later. I think what this does is it opens the door for me to say, what was it we did with the previous bill? What did we allow for that money to be used? What were all of these issues fully vetted, or was it considered very quickly and not the pros and cons not weighed? If I'm reading a note correctly that I have from another source, the PUC does not actually have a position on this, you know, it's just sort of neutral. When I look at how much might be spent, I realize we don't have information on what the project would cost, how much money is being diverted, and whether there was a no-cost or a lesser-cost option. You know, all of these things, it's not only a policy, but it's a choice. What's the most important thing to do with money? And I don't consider this so much our money as the people's money. You know, it was there, as you pointed out very well, to make sure that we're doing what we can to provide access for Oregonians in underserved areas. And is this the best use of that? And perhaps tightening up the language helps some, but for me, it still begs the question, is this how the money should be spent?
Mr. Chair, Q?
You're the number one. Go ahead.
Thanks very much. Thanks a lot. I apologize. I'm not there in person. Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you, Representative Smith. Go ahead.
Great. The comment and then question, and I think Representative Nathanson's comments, as essentially always, are germane and helpful. Where I think it is helpful for our committee to be thinking about it is any of the stuff we've been doing in telecommunications over the last 20 years, certainly over the last longer than that, I think we need to take no better than a neutral stance on whether it made sense, given how fast telecommunication technology has been changing. And I think it's going to take significant shoulder to wheel to update, consider, reevaluate, reconfirm if everything's perfect, our current kind of current way we do things, given that reality. And I want to commend all of us for sort of engaging that question. I have some of the same questions that Representative Nathanson had. Follow up that information with me would be great. And you can feel free to offer further comment. I want to put one little plug and just see if there's anything it can do to be useful. Last session we passed the Broadband Council. Is there anything that can, and that shouldn't be the be-all and end-all of all of our broadband telecommunications thinking, certainly. Is there anything that that council can do to be helpful in this area, because certainly it might be within the ambit of its interest.
Anyone on the panel want to respond to that?
Yeah, I will. Chair Benz, members of the committee.
And you are?
I'm sorry, Brian Conway with the Oregon Public Utility Commission. The first thing I wanted to point out in response to the two comments is that we have not spent any of the money on matching funds or anything for the broadband mapping and planning activities in the state. The U.S. Department of Commerce through the National Telecommunications and Information Administration made an initial grant of $2.1 million available. The governor selected the Oregon Public Utility Commission to receive those funds. And at the last time this bill was up before the legislature, our then chairman, Senator Beyer, had testified that we would first try to exhaust all efforts to use in-kind match. And so, staying true to that, we have not needed to use any of the money. Having said that, NTIA has changed their rules several times throughout this process. We have also applied for and received an initial grant award for an additional $3.55 million to continue mapping in the state. The information is, one, produces an Oregon map. Secondly, the information is sent to the FCC and the NTIA for the federal map that they enrolled February 17th, so yesterday. And we still are not looking to take money from the fund. It's there as a backstop in case we end up in a situation where we do not have in-kind match. So far, the in-kind match has been through data sets that the Department of Administrative Services has put together and offered up, so a portion of that went in. In-kind match comes in the form of time that people spend processing payments for the vendors and things along those lines. And I also want to point out that the Broadband Advisory Council has been very helpful with us. I've been giving regular reports to them on the process and the progress, on the map and various planning activities. In fact, at this point, they're one of the other purpose funds, one of the other planning funds that's included in the $3.55 million. The Broadband Advisory Council, through the Oregon Business Development Department, is planning on being a subrecipient and taking on that task. So we have kept the Broadband Advisory Council involved, and we have not spent the money. And I don't believe it's our intention to spend this money unless it's necessary.
Was that responsive to your question, Representative Smith?
That's helpful, and I'll look forward to hearing more. And if there's things offline that we can do, you know, want to be helpful and encouraging.
Thank you. Are there further questions of the panel? See none. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
That's all I have signed up on this bill. Is there anyone else that wished to be heard? See no one. I will close the public hearing on 2192. And I see nothing for else to come before the committee. Am I right, Zach?
Yes, sir.
And we are adjourned.
Thank you, Representative Smith.